Hello and welcome to The Rest is History, the latest bonus episode. And Tom Holland, we meet in the wake of the revelation that Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, played Paddington in the Ukrainian version of the Paddington films. He did the dubbed voice. And not only that, but he also played a history teacher in the show Servant of the People that propelled him to political stardom, in which he wore, I have to say, an absolutely first-class blue tank top that some eagle-eyed viewers may have seen in such TV series as Cold War Britain with Dominic Sandbrook, The 80s with Dominic Sandbrook, and other similar Paddington-themed historical series. What do you make of that, Tom?
Well, iconic in every way. I mean, Dominic, I'm going to be honest, just a slight dampener.
Yeah.
That we're recording this on Monday, the 28th of February, and we have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, what we do know is that apparently there are kind of hit squads of Russian mercenaries out to get Zelensky. So there are. By the time this goes out, it's perfectly feasible that horrible things will have happened.
Tom, don't go down.
However, with that caveat, I would just like to read a tweet that Ian McKinney put up, in which he says there's another reality where Dominic did take that acting job and by a set of freakish circumstances is now manning the front lines against French invasion.
It's not impossible, Tom. I mean, there's still time.
However, I mean, I entirely accept your point that Zelensky has worn your iconic tank top and that he, you have the Paddington thing in common.
In common.
However, did you... I mean, I assume you've seen the video of him on Strictly.
Yes, I have. Amazing.
Would you ever do that? Would you be able to compete in a kind of dance-off?
I think I could appear, but whether I could compete is a...
Right, okay.
I fear I would be the sort of... For British members of the club, I would be the Ann Widdicombe.
The John Sargent.
Well, the John Sargent. Yeah. I'd be the ludicrous figure who made it through the first round, few rounds, as a sort of ironic gesture from the audience, or as a gesture of pity, but then was unceremoniously turfed off.
Well, okay, but a further thing, did you see the footage of Zelensky playing the piano with his penis?
No, I haven't seen that footage. He isn't getting as much airplay as...
When I say he's playing the piano with his penis, what you're actually seeing is he's standing behind a grand piano with his trousers down and his hands on his head, so it looks as though... That's what he's doing.
I've seen a picture of him in. He posed at some point 10 or 15 years ago, whenever it was, in a sort of leather bondage suit with high heels. Did you see that? Bondage trousers.
Well, high heels, of course. We have an episode coming up on the various torments that fashionistas have visited on one another. And you say that you've never worn high heels. So
no. So another thing another unfortunate divergence from our parallel destinies. I mean, it's an extraordinary... Obviously, a lot of this is... I mean, all of this actually is politically important because it was his outsider status that propelled him to political prominence. But also, it means that the Kremlin obviously didn't take him seriously at all. I mean, he appears to be a... To them, he's a... Because Vladimir Putin is obviously obsessed with manliness and stuff. And Zelensky is just a joke to him.
He's Putin's worst nightmare, isn't he? I mean, he's... Absolutely. You can't, Zelensky is the opposite of kind of riding around wrestling bears, bare-chested and judo and all that kind of stuff. I mean, he's everything. He's the embodiment of the kind of decadence that Putin imagines he's flushing out of Ukraine. So the fury must be, you can tell it's intense.
Of course, yes. Putin's fury, exactly. Anyway, sorry, we've degenerated straight away, haven't we, into a sort of pub conversation, politics conversation. Which is absolutely not what we set out to do. So
I suspect we'll come back to Ukraine. But before that, some graphs.
Well, some pie charts. Mary Kirk Alves, who is a sort of regular on the Discord. Hello, Mary Kirk. You have created this map of Rest is History club members. So to identify yourselves, if you're on that platform, put yourself on the map. And Sam the Belgian has put together a survey to find out our demographics. I mean, the results were limited but interesting, it says here. I mean, they were pretty limited because he appears to have polled 1% of the of the club members. I'm not sure the British Board of pollsters would consider that a mathematical sample. But anyway, male to female, it's about 3/4 to 1/4. Is that, Tom, I would say?
Yeah. Option also listed was eunuch, no eunuchs, non-binary, no, eunuchs. No non-binary either.
So, right. Okay, fine.
Very 20th century collection.
I figure we do have quite a 20th century club base. I mean, I hope I'm not stereotyping our club members. Anyway, you're arrested for a crime you did not commit. Who do you call? Tom, I don't know what to say. Only 37%. Only 37%.
Because only one of us is a superhero. Wouldn't you go for the superhero option?
And the thing is, it's quite hard to get me out of Chipping Norton. So whether I would come to your defence, it depends where you are. I mean, if you're in Whitney, Banbury, Stow-on-the-Wold,
you'd be the one. But anywhere else.
Exactly. It's very unlikely.
I suppose the key to that is just don't get arrested for a crime outside Oxfordshire.
A crime you did not commit. So it's sort of very A-team. I suppose, do they think of me as more as ruthless but effective? Maybe. I don't know. Or just somebody very familiar with
the law. They
probably
think of you as just very, very
kind, Tom.
A man likelier to beat up corrupt policemen than I think is what's floating there.
The Beatles or the Stones?
Good. Beatles win. That's good to see. I think that's reasonable. 67.6. Well, Sam the Belgian pops up again.
Yes.
And he's obviously on fire. Asking, what about pigeons and tortoises?
Yes, so there's been lots of commentary from our club members about future episodes, because obviously we published a sort of preview, didn't we, on Twitter. This is what's coming up. And then Ukraine slightly has unbalanced that. But pigeons are still definitely coming. Tortoises, I don't think we've ever committed ourselves to doing an episode on tortoises, have we, Tom?
No, we haven't. But I quite like the idea of it. It's a challenge.
There was a tortoise. So when I was at Oxford, we had a college tortoise called Rosa Luxemburg, who had been there for decades, I think. But I don't know.
Presumably since what, the 20s?
I think that was a myth, actually. I think she'd probably been there since about 1977 or something.
Oh, I thought,
so when I say decades,
that's a shame.
Decade. But maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
There was one on St. Helena, wasn't there?
That
died very recently.
That's right.
Had known Napoleon.
Yeah, had some great stories about Napoleon.
But I think we've done the episode now. I don't really know what else we can do.
No,
but, a challenge. But I do, as we said last time, we talked about horses. I do like the idea of animal-based episodes.
Tom, cats. You have cats.
Yeah, cats would be great. Yeah.
And am I not right in thinking that, I can't remember, is it Polybius or somebody like that who says there was great outrage in Alexandria, Ptolemaic Alexandria, because a Roman envoy killed a cat.
That's right.
He was beaten to death by the crowd. Yeah. Cats were sacred.
Yeah.
So cats in history is doable. Dogs, obviously. I mean, dogs is basically the theme of the podcast.
Yes, we've killed a
lot
of dogs.
We haven't had a dead
podcast,
dog for a while, but...
Actually, seriously, on the theme of dog, wolves is a brilliant topic.
Wolves.
Really, really good topic. Yes, there's this whole panoply of stories told around the last wolf in England, the last wolf in Scotland, all that kind of stuff.
That your publisher publishes, by Robert Winder, called The Last Wolf, History of England.
And there's one by a brilliant Scottish naturalist called John Crumley called The Last Wolf in Scotland, which is excellent.
Right.
So I think
that's a very good idea.
That's a banker.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of Christianity in it.
And I can talk about Wolverhampton Wanderers.
Yeah, you can. Which they've had a good week, haven't they?
Oh, shut up, Tom.
But seriously, a theme of quite a lot of these books on wolves is that Europeans are uniquely hostile to wolves because of, it is argued, Christian influence.
Tom, that sounds...
Lambs and
serious.
Wolves. No, really? Well, Native Americans love wolves.
Do they?
Yeah, they run with them.
Okay, very good. Well, they dance with them, surely.
They dance with them, sorry, yes. Yeah. They dance with them. Anyway, so that's all to look forward to. What else have we got?
So there was a bit of discussion about Ukraine, which we'll come on to, perhaps. Then there was this episode poll, what episode we were going to do, open to the listeners.
Yes, which I was voting furiously for you to do.
Absolutely,
the
crushingly, I was delighted to see by the historical Jesus. So that is definitely coming. I look forward to Tom doing that episode, and I will also be present. Many, such as pronounced Murray, it says here, are wondering where the idea of Dominic as a Marxist historian started. Now, I thought we'd sort of discussed this on the live stream, but for those people who don't know, it actually started when we did our episode about the causes of the First World War. I think, wasn't it, Tom? And
it was,
I said, Michael Gove, because I think we shouldn't have fought the First World War, Britain shouldn't anyway. And I said, oh, Michael Gove thinks that, you know, lefty historians like me, blah, 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 blah.
At which I exploded.
He did.
In guffaws.
But then that sort of merged with another thing, which was my determinism.
Yeah.
So, because I'm quite determinist.
But also, it's just, I mean, the idea of you as a,
it's just comical,
a notorious left-wing historian is very funny.
It's just
funny.
Comical. And, yeah. And obviously some people, that what's, I mean, lots of people find this very unamusing and tiresome, and probably quite rightly. But what is for us very pleasurable is that every now and again, maybe just once every couple of months, somebody on
will
Twitter,
explode.
Yeah, on takes Twitter. It incredibly Sam seriously. Takes it really seriously, yeah. And will say things like, "I fail to see. I've read his work. I fail to see how you can call himself a Marxist."
But as I said on the live one, I think in many ways you are more left wing than say Alexei Sale, who was dissing you.
That's a big claim. I'm not sure he would. He's a communist.
Yeah, he is, but you know he's less alert to the deep forces, for instance, that underlay 1980s politics in Britain
than you are. Yes, as we discovered. The importance of the microwave oven.
Yeah.
So one last sort of random thing. Simon Girdleston has disgraced himself by saying that there was a discussion about George Smiley, and Simon Girdleston believes that Gary Oldman is a better Smiley than Alec Guinness.
It's because Simon Girdleston is normally very, very sound. I feel his contributions have been excellent. I would give him 10 out of 10. But had he as you say, disgraced himself with this. I mean, obviously it's Alec Guinness.
I mean, Gary Oldman is good, but Alec Guinness is definitive.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And I think John le Carré himself, you know, basically said that Guinness was definitive. So, you know what? So John le Carré would be a good subject for an episode. Tom, are you a John le Carré fan?
Yeah, I am. I remember reading Smiley's People for the first time, and I was on the Circle Line, which is tube line in London that just goes round and round. And I just sat on it and went round. The only thing was you have to change at Edgware Road.
Right.
So I did have to disturb myself there.
This is a great moment, actually, because this says it all about the contrast between the two presenters. Because I also remember where I was when I read Smiley's People. I was in a caravan in Wales.
Do you know, but I've got an even better story about reading Le Carré, which is that we made a film that required us to go from Jordan into Israel. Yeah. And it was a time of kind of heightened tensions between Britain and Israel. So we knew that the Israeli guys at the frontier were going to go through every conceivable item of cameras, everything. So I brought the little drummer girl and I just sat on a chair and read that.
That's a funny book to read going to Israel, I suppose.
Although, it was perfect. It was perfect because they were, you know, it was all about spies.
Yeah, of course.
Frontiers also, and visas.
Yeah,
and
I mean, it's
disguises.
It's actually
it was
a brilliant
absolutely
book.
Perfect.
I think it's. Did you see the TV adaptation of it?
Yeah,
I think it was good.
It. Yeah,
I thought it was good.
Yeah,
but I didn't believe in Florence Pugh.
Oh, I'd always believe in Florence Pugh.
No. I believe in her, but I didn't believe in her as that character. Right, we're just whittering. Let's have some reaction to episodes. Smuggling. I have to say, Smuggling was for me a real unexpected treat. I didn't expect that would be as enjoyable and as richly.
Well, we both learnt a lot, didn't we?
I felt like I learnt loads.
And part of the problem with being the host on a podcast is that, by and large, you don't learn because you've already done the learning. But with Alex, I thought we really did learn.
And also, sometimes when you're the host and you've got a guest, you're just sort of serving up underarm. Bowling in the nets,
yes,
or something, aren't you, Tom?
Half ollies, they're called.
Okay, fine. But Alex was fascinating. And Bertolt Brecht, apparently, is a member of the club. He says he wonders if it reflects poorly on Adam Smith, because we had a quotation from him early in the podcast, sort of defending people who are later revealed as the vilest of criminals. What do we make of this? What do we make of this, Tom? I was kind of surprised.
I don't know.
Actually. I don't know enough about Adam Smith to know whether he's being ironic or... Just trying to be a very ironic person, actually.
Yeah,
I think possibly he's talking about smuggling more generically.
Well, do you know what we could do?
What?
Is, we've got Colin Kidd coming on, who's the great historian of the Scottish Enlightenment.
Ask him.
He's coming on at the end of this week, so we could ask him. He's coming on to talk about
smuggling.
The Acts of Union. So we could ask him. Let's do
that. Okay, fine. Valentine's. Norn. Great episode.
Isn't that Gnorn?
Gnorn says, great episode. It's frustrating we have so little evidence to explain why Chaucer and his contemporaries began the tradition of associating Valentine with love.
It is.
Tom, is there no answer to this, really? Is there no clue?
I think it's something to do with the idea that Valentine's Day marks the time when birds start getting off with one another.
Yeah,
that's animals start getting off with one another.
Do they though on Valentine's Day? I
mean, well, so there are two possible dates for Valentine. So it may be right. Early May, which okay. actually seems and a kind of likely time. Maying is the time for
right. Okay.
You know, so it's very difficult. It is frustrating, but I think it's also more romantic that way. I think the sense of mystery around it kind of dignifies it.
Okay, fine.
Don't you? I think it's.
I suppose so. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
A bit of mystery in our calendar is good.
Okay.
Oh, Sam the Belgian's back.
You could sense the podcast of bromance when they were reading the Vinegary Valentines. And then he's written a Valentine of himself, of his own. Tom's into Jesus, Dominic's into Marx, but when they're together, their bromance just sparks.
Oh, that's lovely.
I don't know what you can say about that, except I'm not really into Marx, so kind of...
It's a joke, Dominic.
Okay, fine. Thanks, Tom. Terence, Dominic's female voice, a very good comment this, Dominic's female voice in the Valentine's episode sounded very similar to his Margaret Thatcher voice in the Who Dares Wins audiobook. Now, we've never really done Margaret Thatcher in it. We're on 150 episodes, but she hasn't really featured. And I do a Margaret Thatcher voice when I do the audiobook, the 48-hour audiobook recording of Who Dares Wins. But I like to keep that up my sleeve.
But what I think that implies, so he's Terence M is implying
yeah.
that every female voice you do sounds like Margaret Thatcher. A bit no, like Tom, every male right voice you do sounds like Winston Churchill. So essentially, the only impressions you can do are British Conservative prime ministers.
No, because I did Donald Trump defending the Abergavenny massacre, if you remember.
Yes,
remember
right.
that? Donald
yes.
Trump as Hugh de Broglie. Yes,
okay, well, can you do any female voice that doesn't sound like Margaret Thatcher?
I'd have to think about that. I have to be honest. I've never done any other female voice. I mean, this is a great... Perhaps this is why I didn't get that Paddington. Just because they felt I didn't have sufficient
Paddington...
range. No, but had they been wanting to do a sort of woker Paddington, where Paddington is a bit more fluid, I wouldn't have been the man for that voice. I think that's fair to say. Vladimir Zelensky could have done it, but
they weren't
going to
do that. They weren't going to do that in what, the 90s?
I might have done a gender fluid Macbeth, because of course Macbeth was going to be the bridge. That's the bridge that I didn't take. Yeah. Right, we're getting definitely bogged down. American Crusades. Now, Judith says, enjoyed the American Crusades episode, even though there was the persistent drumbeat of the centrality of Christianity. Well, I mean, to be fair, that's kind of in the title. I mean, the centrality of Christianity is Andrew's argument. It was a relief to hear Professor Preston being somewhat circumspect. I'm resistant to the concept of Christ. Oh my gosh, Tom. Shocking for you, this.
Judith, explain yourself here.
I'm resistant to the concept of Christianity explaining so much of history. Over the years of my study of history, I've seen humanism as a greater driving force for good and sometimes ill. Tom, what on earth are you going to say to that? Because that runs counter to all you stand for.
It's absolute heresy.
So basically, I think...
Time is too short.
Judith, yeah. Tom would require...
Well, if only I'd written a book about it. Oh, I have.
Yeah, I was just about to say, Judith, I think you should, if you haven't read, maybe she has
maybe
read
she
hasn't, Dominion.
You're not convinced by it.
Yeah, it's utterly unconvinced. But if you haven't read it, Tom's book, Dominion, I do have to say, I heartily recommend Tom's book, Dominion.
Bless
and
you,
even
God.
If you don't think that Christianity is central, I think you might if you read his book. But maybe you've read it and you reject that.
Or Andrew Preston's.
Or Andrew Preston's. His book, Sword of the Spirit, Shield of Faith, his colossal book about the centrality of Christianity in America's place in the world. Anyway.
Dreadnought. Sorry, yeah. you read it.
No, you go for it, Tom.
Okay. A great episode, but no mention of the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. Surely America's most extensive empire is the one based on the form of American capitalism it exports around the world. American capitalism is underpinned by a crusading passion that their brand of capitalism is good and righteous.
My quibble with that, though, Tom, would be how is American capitalism different from Victorian British capitalism?
Well, I think the kind of Anglo-American Atlantic form of Protestantism is very important to this. I mean, we did briefly touch on how it relates to Britain, but I do think that I mean, for instance, I think one of the reasons why people in Britain were so ready to join Black Lives Matter marches, even though the events that they were protesting against happened on the other side of the Atlantic, mm-hmm. is that it was drawing on a kind of common stock of assumptions and narratives and ideals that dates back really, to the founding of New England and America.
I think I agree with that, Tom. And you know what's fascinating is that lots of people abroad agree with that too. So obviously, famously, Charles de Gaulle, when he vetoed Britain joining the common market that became the European Union, did so because he said they're basically not European, they're Anglo-Saxons. He believed that it was a shared Anglo-Saxon.
Well, there's been all this remarkable stuff from Putin talking about Anglo-Saxons.
Exactly.
I mean, honestly,
that.
You know, I read at the same time as he's talking about the Rus.
So what's absolutely bizarre is that, so just yesterday, some Russian news outlets, by mistake, published an essay that had clearly been written written in advance to mark what they thought would be a very quick invasion and occupation.
I mean, imagine being the guy who pressed the wrong button.
And it went out on about four different outlets, and people screenshotted it before they very hastily deleted it.
About
basically, you know, what we've done is we've reincorporated the Ukraine, we've made Russia whole again. It was all this sort of stuff. And in the course of this, there was an awful lot of stuff about multipolar, the world is multipolar now. And it talked about Russia and Eurasia, and it talked about Europe, and then it talked about the Anglo-Saxons, the Atlanticists. And
Oceania.
It very rarely used the word America or Britain. It kept saying Anglo-Saxons, Anglo-Saxons. And I thought, God, that's so interesting that because we in Britain spend so much time arguing about is there such a thing as a special relationship? And actually, no one in Britain would ever use that expression, would they, Tom?
Anglo-Saxons?
Only about the Anglo-Saxons. I mean, we wouldn't use it about us and America. We wouldn't say we are Anglo-Saxon powers. You know, we are an Anglo-Saxon bloc. We are anything.
Of that kind. You're about to set me off on one of my hobby horses here.
Is this about Anglo-Saxons?
Yes.
Being cancelled?
Yes.
Well, let's do that. And that's a separate issue. I agree with you.
Americans. Well, Americans in humanities departments.
Oh, you are going down this road. Okay, fine.
Very cross about it because they say Anglo-Saxon is a racist term because it's used in America is obviously rooted in all kinds of white supremacy and all that kind of thing, and therefore it should be cancelled everywhere, universally.
And what do
despite
you think,
the
Tom?
Fact that it
what
does
do you
not
think?
Have that meaning in Britain.
No. And I think they're my ancestors. Piss off. Right, anyway. Can you say that on the podcast? I suppose you can. It's the bonus podcast. Amy Mantravadi, on more serious matters, has a really, really good point. So we talked a bit about American empire with Andrew Preston, didn't we? And she says, what is an empire? And actually, we did an episode about empires, and I don't think we ever really nailed down what an empire was. So she thinks it has to be a sort of sizable area. It has multiple ethnic and cultural groups. I agree with that. Has substantial economic and political influence beyond its borders.
Yeah.
And having a clear tendency towards expansion. Now, interestingly, I probably wouldn't agree with her on number four because, I mean, obviously we did our Fall of Rome podcast, which just came out today, the day we were recording. And Rome did have a tendency toward expansion, but then it stopped, didn't it? I mean, it didn't expand after, what, Trajan?
But it still had an ideology of expansion.
Did it though, Tom?
It did.
Did it really?
Yeah. Imperium sine fine, empire without limit.
It
absolutely did.
Okay,
yes.
Let's take... But then there have been other empires that didn't have, that after the initial period of expansion, I mean, the Belgian Empire didn't have a logic of expansion, surely.
I think given a chance, they would have done.
Well, maybe, I suppose. So, yeah, I mean, maybe. I think, this is the interesting question. What's the difference between an empire and a kingdom? You know?
Well, that would be a good episode, wouldn't it?
What is an empire?
Because just today we've released When Did the Roman Empire Fall? I quite like the idea of setting these essay questions that we then have to try and answer.
Right. Yeah. You're obviously nostalgic for your A-level days. Now, here's one for you, Tom. This is from Dimwi. I have a question regarding the word crusade, which has always bugged me. The Crusades were attempts at Christendom to recapture formerly Christian lands after they had been captured. The word is now generally deemed offensive, but it's always occurred to me the original Crusades were a reaction to an outside aggression. Why do we hold the reaction to the aggression to be offensive, but not the aggression itself? Now, by the aggression, I'm guessing that Dimwi means the original Arab conquest of the Levant.
I guess. Yeah. Because the focus of the Crusades is Jerusalem.
But surely the one answer to that, I suppose, Dimwi, would be that... But what is the answer to that? Because obviously a considerable time period separates the Arab conquests from the Crusades. But as you say, we do kind of slightly beat ourselves up now about the Crusades and say, oh, naked expansionism, you know, slaughter and all that. But I suppose you could say the same about the Arab conquests, couldn't you?
Of course you could. Yeah, absolutely.
So they're no different.
People do.
No, they don't. No one says that.
Of course they do.
If you're ever having an argument,
there's lots of grumblings about jihad and Arab conquests. And
I don't think. I mean, not among. No, I think, Tom, if I've ever in the conversation with some, you know, some sort of high-minded academic-y person.
Yeah, among high-minded academic-y
people.
Know,
but empires are always evil.
But Dominic, have you looked at the French
election? The Ottoman Empire, the Arab Empire, and they're like, oh, no, well, they weren't evil. You know, in that way that people do.
About 60% of the French electorate are preparing to vote for people who are grumbling about jihads. I would say the crusade has traditionally had a very positive connotation in English. You know, a crusade against poverty, all that kind of stuff. I think that it's come to have negative connotations for two reasons. One is that it is associated with the fanaticism of the religious. Judith would be pleased. I think it's a kind of humanist enlightenment take on religion as being benighted, superstitious, predatory, mad, all that kind of stuff. And I think also it's because the Crusades have been conflated with subsequent European imperialism.
Well, with the War on Terror, George Bush's use.
Well, yes, and then the War on Terror, yes. So it's seen as kind of, you know, a universal constant that evil Europeans invading everywhere.
I think it's Euro 2016, Tom, when France, there was a campaign in some quarters to stop England football fans wearing Crusaders outfits. Did you see this?
Well, they're wearing St. George outfits as well. I mean,
perceive them as Crusader outfits because they have this sort of white, they wear a sort of fake chain mail and a white surcoat. And
how did that campaign go?
Well, it didn't go very well. And you know what? Her Majesty's Daily Mail rang me up and asked me my opinion. And I told them the truth, which was that Sambrook Jr. had such an outfit. there was some talk at one stage, would he agree to be photographed in the newspaper for a rant, for a photograph accompanying a tirade by me against the high-minded righteous people who wanted to ban Crusader outfits?
And how did that go?
I was well up for it. He was well up for it. But I'm afraid to say that the third member of our household...
Well, I'm completely with Catherine on that. I think that would have been a terrible disaster. And he would even now be... Well, he'd be like Putin trying to get rid of all those screenshots of...
He was the article that
had been sent out by mistake.
He was so up for that, Tom. I can't tell you. All right. Let us press on. Most disastrous parties. I have to say, recording that episode was such fun.
What we haven't said is that the very first one about the tutu, we lost it for about 3 minutes, didn't we?
And actually, the huge chunk
of it had to be cut out.
It did, because it's just incapable of speech, kind of
gasping for breath.
Yeah. Because I think we had, we both had in mind the photo of him, because he's such a sturdy, stolid bloke. So dramatic.
Well, I had him in front of me as I was looking, and just made it very, very funny. So Si James nominates Gordon Bennett. Renowned lad, went to a New Year's Day party at his fiancé's parents, got riotously drunk, urinated in the fireplace, was horsewhipped by fiancé's brother, ended up fighting a duel before being ostracised and heading to Paris in self-exile. Some versions say the target was the grand piano for his urination was the grand piano rather than the fireplace.
I don't know this story at all, Tom.
I didn't know it at all either.
Is this the ancestor of the phrase Gordon Bennett? I guess which is sort of, for overseas listeners, is a British phrase meaning kind of...
Struth for our Australian listeners.
Yeah. Well, maybe Si James can get back in touch and tell us what's going on.
Elaborate.
So, to Ukraine. We had one very disgruntled listener who I believe will not be listening to this episode because he's left the...
Maybe he is still out there. That's Burning Archive, who says, "I'm sorry to swim against the stream." And the stream being the generally positive reaction to the episode, but I was deeply disappointed with it. I found it misleading, facile, with concerning omissions and fudges, and weirdly sentimental. It seems reflective of the crazed Russia anxiety that Mark B. Smith describes. I simply do not know why this cultural virus has infected the Anglo-American elite so badly. Really? regrettably, I intend to leave the club since there is simply too much Russophobic hysterical nonsense in the British media, and sadly, on this otherwise enjoyable podcast.
Well, Russophobic, hysterical nonsense.
I in no way think I'm Russophobic. However, what I would say is that I'm Putinophobic, and I've been rabidly Putinophobic. I'm rabidly Putinophobic ever since he attacked Salisbury, which is my hometown. And he could easily have killed thousands of people. It was absolutely shameful.
So this is the poisoning.
The poisoning with the Novichok.
Yeah.
And they were kind of spraying it round. I mean, you know, my parents, my brother, my friends, they could all have got it on their skin. I mean, it's awful, awful. And this man, anyway.
No, so. I think it's good to see you getting fired up, Tom. I don't think we are a Russophobic podcast. In fact, I know we're not a Russophobic podcast. I'll tell you why. Because I know that you've been on holiday, you've done your walk around St. Petersburg, haven't you? You're a big fan of, as I am, of Dostoevsky, of Tolstoy, of Turgenev, of Russian literature generally. But I think there's a big difference between the regime and the country.
And I have enough Russian friends to know that Putin is not Russia, which is something that's absolutely essential to remember, especially at the moment, that, you know, it's the two are not the same thing at all. But I'm definitely hostile to the government of Russia, which, you know, there's a kind of absolute continuum between spraying polonium over English market cathedral cities and what they're doing in Ukraine at the moment, and what they've done in Aleppo and Grozny. And
so there's a pattern of, I would say, now, of course, some people will say, well, there's a Western pattern of bad behavior. And I think there is of course, the West makes mistakes, sometimes very grievous mistakes. But I think, well, I mean, these are very murky waters. We have made sometimes terrible errors, but I think errors born of hubris, idealism, miscalculation, rather than, I don't think they were ever born of genuine kind of malevolent resentment or hatred or any of these kinds of things, at least not in our lifetime, Tom. Would you agree with that?
Well, again, I think it's always... I mean, it's kind of wrong to assume that if you criticize a government, you're therefore criticizing every person in the country.
Yeah, of course.
That government belongs to.
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't follow at all.
Yeah.
Mike Chapman, I believe Ukraine is the only nuclear power to unilaterally disarm. The only comparable example was Gaddafi being persuaded to end Libya's nuclear program. They're not exactly encouraging precedents, are they?
Yeah, Ukraine did disarm. So it had
South Africa.
Yes, I think South Africa abandoned its nuclear program, didn't it? It did, exactly, yes. Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. I mean, it wasn't really Ukraine's nuclear, but Soviet nuclear weapons left in Ukraine in the mid-1990s in return for guarantees about its security and its border, which unfortunately were not then upheld.
Yeah.
But yes, Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. I mean, it was very much kind of on the, you know, it was a priority of Western policymakers to get Ukraine to give up its nuclear weapons in the 1990s because they basically
And the irony is, is it not that they've now gone into Belarus?
The nuclear weapons?
Yeah. So they've signed a kind of new agreement, a new treaty with Russia, and I think it's all part of the package that's kept whatever his name is
Lukashenko.
In power, Lukashenko, so Tom, for another kind of 20 years or something. The part of it is that Putin now he's able to move all his nuclear missiles into Belarus.
So I have been to Belarus. Have you been to Belarus?
I know I have, because it featured on...
Yeah, Belarus is not a place I would recommend as a holiday destination. As people often say, people sometimes jokingly used to say it's like a Soviet theme park because it's very much like the Soviet Union never ended. And it's a very great, I mean, obviously, Belarus suffered horrendously in World War II. So basically, all of its historic towns, the city centers were destroyed. So it's pure tower blocks. And it's very, very gray. The thing that really struck me about it was it made me yearn for kind of Western advertising, because you would walk down the streets and you just wouldn't see the posters and the bright lights and the kind of you know, that sort of jolly imagery of ads that you're so used to here. It was just utterly grey and depressing. It also had the worst chocolate of anywhere I've ever been.
On that theme, I remember very shortly after the Berlin Wall came down, going with a friend from Hamburg to Berlin, and we drove through East Germany, I suppose it still was East Germany. We passed through this incredibly grey town where there was absolutely no marketing, no advertising or anything. And then we saw a great splash of color. We slowed down to see what it was. Sex shop.
Oh God.
That was the first taste of Western capitalism in this town.
That's probably a good note on which to end, Tom. I think you can only go downhill from there,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah. Well, actually, Belarus, did you go to the kind of the primordial forest?
No. I didn't. I know the one you mean. It's the last great kind of prehistoric forest in Europe or something.
That's right. And the bison.
Yeah, it's on the border of...
with Poland and...
Poland. So that's where, I think it's the Belowezha, I think is what they call it. I think that's where Boris Yeltsin and the leaders, the then leaders of Belarus and Ukraine, Shushkevich and Kushmar, I think it was. I might be wrong. Signed the deal. Maybe it was Kravchuk. I can't remember my Ukrainian leaders. Anyway, they signed the deal to dissolve the Soviet Union in forest, in a hunting
lodge. Why in a forest? Oh, I see. So
they'd gone to a hunting lodge.
Yeah,
right.
Okay.
You know, they didn't just drive out into a clearing.
Just go for a walk.
Yeah, no, it was in a hunting lodge in this forest. And that's where they signed the deal behind Gorbachev's back to dissolve the Soviet Union in early December 1991, which is, I think, a subject that we're planning to revisit because it feels we've often talked about during the end of the Soviet Union. And it would be
timely, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it feels timely. So we're probably going to revisit that. I mean, it's seismic. It's probably one of the biggest events we've ever lived through.
So we're thinking about that. We might do that, record that this week rather than JFK. So we'll push JFK back a week.
Yeah.
Is that the thinking?
Possibly, yeah. I think that might be a good idea because I think a lot of people, although in absolutely not and never will be a politics or current affairs podcast, I think sometimes people enjoy it when we do, we cast a sort of historical eye on events in the news and provide a bit of context and stuff. And I think it's sometimes important, actually, Tom, with Afghanistan and with, I think we both do, don't we? That it matters, actually, to give things a bit of context because there's a lot of bad commentary around, particularly on social media.
Yeah. But
I mean, Burning Archive would say there's a lot of bad commentary on this podcast, but
yes, he would.
We don't agree with him.
Well, I mean, maybe it is, but I wouldn't, I don't think that we're Russophobic. I mean,
no.
I don't think that is
a, I know we're not.
A fair charge.
I know we're not.
But people who are worried that perhaps there's a bit too much holding of the mirror up to current affairs, please be reassured that this Thursday we have a fantastic episode that has absolutely nothing to do with current situation on lethal fashion.
Yeah.
So that is corsets, high heels. We've already mentioned hats, all that
hats
kind of stuff.
Hats that kill.
Hats that kill.
Like Oddjob's hat.
Yeah. Well, it's so revelatory, isn't it? I thought it was such an amazing
topic. It's a good episode. It's a really good episode.
Who knew that hats had been so dangerous?
The number of people killed by hats. Yeah, exactly. It's really bizarre and fascinating.
And actually tutus. So
yeah, so Dietrich von Hülsenhäwler, whatever his name is.
Well, at the start of this year, if you'd said that a major focus of our episodes was going to be tutus, I wouldn't have believed you.
We could do an episode on the... Edgar Degas, French painter. And that would further.
Well, we could set ourselves the challenge of, can we get tutus into as many episodes as possible?
Like that Spandau Ballet challenge that we lasted
we
like
failed,
two episodes.
We failed, didn't we? We kind of ducked.
Exactly.
I think it was Duran Duran.
Was it Duran Duran? No.
Yeah, it was Duran Duran.
God, yeah. Duran Duran would be outraged that I called them Spandau Ballet because they...
Same difference.
There's no love lost between those bands, Tom.
No.
Right. On that note, I think we should say farewell and we will see you all next time or whenever we see you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.